got about half an hour until the bus comes to take people to meet rides back to the hotel, And Ian and I talked about, you know, not having any sort of, let Annalise do a more formal closing, if you will. But we did want to have a conversation, just kind of have a little bit of a wrap-up discussion to give people an opportunity to, talk about just, things that emerged for them from the conference, whether they're observations, themes, questions, maybe also think a little bit about, how to maintain dialogue among small groups or the larger group. That's something we can also discuss over email, which might be part of the answer. But so before, I will say we're recording this as well, in part because Annalise had to take off and wanted to be able to share it with her. But like everyone else, I actually want to very publicly thank Ian and the Miller Center and the great guys up in the booth. and Marcus. I have been thinking for a long time that, as Annalise alluded, I've been thinking about this kind of work for a very long time, and I've also been thinking about wanting to have this kind of dialogue. And when Ian suggested we'll come here at the Miller Center, it was like this gift dropped into my lap, and I certainly felt that way this past week when I felt a little bit guilty when I think about the detail of what I could do with it was say, Ian, what do you do about this? So I'm incredibly in your debt and grateful and thankful because this has been such a fruitful experience for me. So.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you too. Academic institutions are always in evolution to some degree, and this one is very much so. And it's been really wonderful to have you all here and get these voices in this institution. It's a battle. I thought Ken Germany's fought for a long time, and I think we finally had some receptivity upstairs, as it were, and having you all here, and I can see this for me intellectually and institutionally. Thank you for all of that.
And I don't want to think of these as closing remarks as much as maybe wrap up of the conference and lead into where this dialogue continues down the road in our written work and in our continuing conversations with each other. But that said, I really just want to open the floor to folks to share any things that are still kicking around.
Well, I think I sort of know a lot. I kind of felt like I kind of put two thoughts together this morning, and I kind of apologize for that. But the reason is I went back and I was reading Dan's paper over again this morning, and I kept looking at things and, that's kind of like what I got here and I got there. And I started thinking about some of what you all guys were saying and whatnot. And the ability for me to concentrate on what I was supposed to say was just so overwhelmed by all the other stuff that I heard. It kind of like I was thinking more about what you guys were saying than what I was trying to say.
It came together fine.
Oh, well.
Not just because of strawberry infusion.
But I did. When those new council papers opened up, and I'm just kind of going through this, and I'm thinking, where's this coming from? What's going on? How am I going to think about this? How do I take this, into the 70s? I had no clue. I didn't know what I was dealing with, and then reading all this stuff was just, doors flying open, all those other kind of deep metaphors. So, it's just, God sent to me, and I appreciate it.
I think I mentioned it just briefly, and I think this is something that came up time and again, and it just sort of steps off from those points. The level of continuity between these movements and the kinds of things people did in all these different cities that we might have thought were very unique and very different because the people were themselves unique and different, but that they did have to come into contact with structural barriers. I just thought the similarities in the movement cycles were the things that really struck me. And if we had somebody really well versed in social movement theory, they probably would have helped us think about that sort of framing. But it did strike me that there was this kind of structural element of similarity in many of the movements, which, I mean, we get into, you know, these become movements that we attach ourselves to. But yet, you know, it was nice to see so much of the same sort of thing going on, and then maybe to think a little bit about how we can walk away from this, think about what those structures are and how they created this environment, or, you know, how people reacted to it and changed those structures. So I thought that was the most helpful thing for me, to see all those connections between all these different community groups, which, you know, we can get down into the micro level stuff and forget that there's so much in common going on here in these communities.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the larger audience that should be reading this book. And I'm thinking about a lot of the policy people I've been listening to, and a group of historians who really do stress the structural. There's a new line of historiography. I'm seeing it in Tom Segrue's synthesis of the civil rights movement in the North. And it's some real points that stresses the limits of place-based strategies, and so that, you know, up against urban apartheid, up against the socially engineered landscapes of inequality, right, up against tax policy and the maldistribution of income, up against corporate disinvestment, you know, this stuff was very limited, right? But, you know, all the precluding clauses, this stuff was very limited. It seems that, you know, to be able to shift the focus of attention to say, okay, perhaps true, that's the structural trends towards geographic apartheid, towards economic maldistribution, towards deregulation. In the context of all those things, it matters what people do, where they live, you know. And it matters how we define community too, because a lot of this literature defines community as what? Neighborhood. You know, as the way the OEO often defined it, but communities, and, you know, I'll just say your paper, Mark, communities are built, and they can be built through political coalition building. And in a way, I think a lot of these groups were also aware of the structural issues. You know, speaking about full employment, you know, or about ending the war in Vietnam, or about, you know, integration, for God's sake. I mean, in some ways, the integrationist dream, you know, was buried for a lot of reasons. I'd say mainly reaction, but also in response, more of a community-focused approach. You know, I think some of this critique has merit. There are a couple other books, and this piece by Nick Lemon that came out a few years ago, that's really saying, look at the place-based tradition, there's nothing there for policymakers. And I think it's part of the left structuralist pessimism that, you know, we're kind of aware of with Alan Matisseau's book, you know, that needs to be, you know, well succeeded, but also spoken to and addressed. And that's what's happening, I think, the policy circles, this definition of place-based strategies and people versus people-based strategies.
I think it's interesting that given the level of national politics, that there's a bit of a tension here, I think, even between the Obama campaign and the Edwards campaign and the way they're dealing with these issues today. I see Edwards as much more people-based in this consensus, whereas Obama's coming out of the community with his tradition, and it's not something that the mass media knows or understands. I think his strategies are actually place-based in contradiction of this.
The activists themselves knew these weren't exclusive strategies.
Well, I mean, also the thing, you know, just to critique that overly structural view a little bit, is it also means that the scholar doesn't have to do that work. If the thing already explains itself as part of a broader process, you don't have to do the difficult work. And in talking to people like Segrue and other folks who do that work, it seems that that's the one thing that they have problems doing. So, I mean, part of it is the big intellectual artifice. The other part is the kind of work that certain scholars enjoy doing or don't want to do. And I think that's a critique that people are probably generally afraid to put out there.
I was just wondering if you could, I got lost in your elaborating when you say that's the kind of work they want.
If you don't want to get into the community organizations, you don't want to do the oral history. I talk to a lot of folks who make the structural argument who just say to me things like, man, that's so much, I tried to do some of those when I was starting this dissertation and I envisioned the dissertation going in a different direction or the second book or whatever. And, you know, waiting for people to meet you at a bus stop or at Denny's or, you know, it's just annoying. And that's not a personal critique, but it's a critique that strikes me that explains some of that. Right?
But one of the things that I found, and I don't know if you guys found this too, is that in terms of leadership, it seems like part of what happened in the 70s is that the leaders of the various movements just got really tired and were tired of being poor themselves and were talented people who didn't want to be in the community organizing anymore, who wanted to start raising families and doing other things. And is that part of the reason why the spirits were burned out in the early 70s? And if you talk to them, like you interview them, they're like, yeah, I was there, and they seem kind of exasperated to other people I talk to, at least.
Sometimes their kids are the ones that are writing the dissertation. I mean, so there's this whole other element of spiritual change that you leave out if all you have is burned out cities and parking lots. You forget that, you know, some of this actually led folks to change and, you know, move on and get educated and do all sorts of things. I think that's left out. We just have this really dim view. And I'm pretty dim. You've heard me before, a lot of you. But I think it's maybe that's an oversimplification because you miss the black middle class, the Latino middle class, that, you know, sort of grows out of a lot of this, you know.
I don't know. I think it takes different forms sometimes. Because I'm just thinking, the guy's in his 80s now, or 80 or something like that. Laura Jones is the last executive director of the County of Southern Mountains and made his transformation post-1970. And he never left Berea, came here from Western North Carolina, somewhere along the line, I can't remember, you know, in the 50s. And then you start seeing the rise in places like Berea, UK, even at UKU or Robbins, the rise of Appalachian Studies Centers and whatnot, which hadn't we thought about. I think about where this goes afterward. You see a different, sometimes a different tack. And you go back to read what Jones is writing in the 60s, and it's very this. I think, Dan Gannon, I think he put in your paper more than my own, is that when the organization for Indian, OIO, whatever that was, you know, it's got a very neutral stance, and that's the way the Warm Poverty starts out. In the 60s, when they get 64, 65, very neutral before they get to the issue of organized one way. And Laurel Jones is all there for the neutrality stance, but then sort of once he resigns from that Council of Southern Mountains, you hear him speak today, you know, he'd been arrested for sedition back in the 60s. You know, so he's got, it's not that tired at all, he's in his 80s and he's still hammering. And a lot of these, you know, some of the guys I've talked to, they go from being, you know, volunteers to now they're housing inspectors. One of them is an insurance salesman, but he's a, you know, you think of an insurance salesman, you know, think of looking for Aflac or something like that. He's got the duck or something. But he's pretty vociferous, and he's in Danville, Kentucky now. There's a lot of them came down, and then those waves that brought in those, you know, however you define them, insider, outsider thing. There's a lot of them that are still in eastern Kentucky, still doing things. So maybe it's a strange dynamic that we can't pin as, you know, the generation moves on. Sometimes maybe they don't.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to just keep talking, but looking at, for example, this history that Howard Fuller had that I knew nothing about, even though he was such a pivotal person in Milwaukee's educational history. Mm-hmm. Also thinking about some of the activists in my own project that are, you know, one's a special assistant to the governor of Wisconsin for Latino affairs, and I think makes a real difference in that role. Another just resigned from the University of Wisconsin System Board of Governors, basically, over the issue of providing educational opportunity to undocumented children who had lived in Wisconsin for some number of years. And so, yeah, there's this whole story that connects to the structural question, I think. Mm-hmm. These people become part of the structure. And yes, the, you know, the radical dream of, you know, whoever's dream it is might not be the end game here. That there is, to some degree, a belief in, oh, I have to say at once, right, some of the tenets of Enlightenment liberalism and, you know, American liberalism in some of its forms. That even the most radical young people in 1968 find themselves making decisions about, well, do I work for the housing inspecting folks here in this city or this county, or do I just continue to be upset with the whole structure?
I think they make those decisions. I think it's where Black Lung comes from. Sorry, Susan.
Well, I just wanted to kind of throw out, too, even how current events can affect the way you look back on the people you've studied. This whole U.S. attorney scandal reminded me that Jeff Sessions was the U.S. attorney in Alabama. He's now the senator in Alabama. And they, when he was attorney general, investigated people in the Alabama Black Belt that had been in these third parties. And they have the trial in Mobile, and it's not in the Black Belt, and the people who were accused of voter fraud were all these people that were involved in this National Democratic Party of Alabama, and then they end up countersuing. And so there's sometimes something can happen today that then you think, oh my gosh, this was happening in the 80s, and it, I don't know, I just think when you think of the political piece of this and where these movement people go and how they just keep going, and but yet are, at least in Alabama, still being tried to be snuffed out in various ways and continuing to fight that fight. And just to follow up, Shirley Mesher ended up going to Hawaii and organizing pineapple, indigenous people who worked in the pineapple fields, went to law school, and then came back to Seattle. And Frances Walter left Selma, went to Birmingham, and ran group homes for mentally retarded people, and then became a parish priest, and they did a lot of ministry for homeless people. So, you know, this can go in all kinds of directions.
I have to jump in here because Dan asked me earlier what I'm going to do next, and I told him I had a couple of different ideas. But I have something kicking around. It's partly a research project, but that I'm thinking more broadly about. That's also a political education project, which would be an oral history project that anyone here could be part of as a teacher, where we teach, where we train students in the idealized form. It's a spring class that is oral history methodology and learning about social movements of the 1960s, funded in the dream world where there's funding for this, where students interview veterans of the 60s movements to address these very questions of, okay, you know, what were you doing before the 60s? How did you get into the movements in the 60s? And then what happened? And so it's at once getting the longer trajectories of these lives, which actually Annalise is someone who does this so well. but it's also potentially an opportunity for the students to have a politicizing experience. And then on campuses where this would work, you know, perhaps a fall follow-up, but it's also a public history component of what do we do with these histories now that we have them, whether it's, you know, building websites or museum pieces or whatever. And I just, because this thing came up in this room and so many people seem to be dealing with it, I did want to articulate that I've been really kind of obsessed with this idea for the past month, in those few moments that I wasn't obsessed with this conference. and so I just sort of offered out there, both in terms of, you know, inviting people to, you know, to join me in thinking about how this might take place and who might fund it and things like that, and sort of something that we could all build on.
It's beginning to happen at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities under a Teaching American History grant.
Well, that's
when they get to the civil rights. Yeah, like for anybody who's interested.
Mm-hmm. I know there was another hand up somewhere.
Oh, okay. I kind of forgot what I was going to say, but I think I was thinking about this question about from a social movement perspective, that a lot of the, when you read these histories, you realize that people understood that this was a question of organizing, like almost in a labor movement sort of way, that these were projects that were going to have to be continually reorganized. And as we think about that, I think it's important to not just look at continuities, but also discontinuities. And I see this a lot in my work in Newark, because a lot of the people who are in power were in the Sharp James administration, which recently got voted out amid a lot of corruption, and are now locked in battles over newer organizations that are cropping up. So I think there's a way in which, as we look into the future, it's going to be different organizations kind of coming in with, you know, different institutional histories, replaying these battles, and that maybe sometimes there's a danger in sort of looking. I mean, I think it's great to look at the trajectory of people's lives, but also seeing a person's life as sort of more coherent, and that I think the ways in which people deal with these constraints actually sort of does change their political ideology over time, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. And it's a, I mean, from my perspective, it's you know, one of the most kind of pessimistic things is how these changes, like something about the culture of poverty, sort of changes what people actually believe about themselves and the capacity of sort of the poorest of the poor. So I guess that's a pessimistic statement about getting beaten down over time. But there's definitely optimistic glimmers in it. But also this question, there's that book, American Project. I don't know if any of you have read this by, I think,
Venkatesh.
Yeah, about the Charles, is it Charles Taylor Projects in Chicago?
I think it's the Robert Taylor.
Robert Taylor. Where he talks about organizing in the projects over like three or four generations, and this question of how sort of people sort of pass down organizing strategies to their children and how the children readapt that. And I don't know if that's an interesting example of that. I don't agree with all his conclusions, but as a methodology, it's, I think he's a sociologist too, so he's making it big earlier. But
well, I'm trying to make sense of where this discussion is headed, and I'm wondering if, like, what it's about in terms of the volume. Is that what you're trying to speak
sure.
to? Okay, so Rhonda and I will try. And is this about audience? Who we're writing to, is that how the issue of policy came up? And then also, is there an assumption here that, like, everyone is rooted in their take on the war on poverty, that this collection of scholars is rooted in social movements? Or do we have, in your putting together the group of people, do we have people coming at it from different directions that are speaking
yes.
together in this volume?
I think both. I do think that I don't think there's anyone in the volume who doesn't at least have some strength in social movements. Mm-hmm. I do think that we're coming at it in a lot of different directions in terms of both the populations, but also the, you know, the questions that have been most central to our own work. And you know, not to overstate the diversity here, because, you know, there might be 8 to 10 different themes that, you know, 3 to 5 of them run through the work of any given person. I'm not sure what that says. And I've confessed that I sort of picked up on something in the world of conversation with the volume.
Oh,
and
no,
I,
no, I just was. Because it had started with you talking about Sugru's work and policy, and that brought the attention more to local local people and interviewing them, and then we kind of went on into trajectories of those people. And so I was just wondering, in terms of, I think what this was about was audience and what the messages of this, or possible messages, larger themes in the volume.
Actually, I was going a different way, but it was based on the
volume.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's connected to that, because what I've been trying to think about as we sit here what happens when the book comes out, as opposed to your kind of conceptualizing how entire volume fits together. But it's very much connected to that, because I'm trying to think of where maybe we could have forms so that when the book comes out, in places that could get picked up by not just academics, but by policymakers. So,
right.
You know, for instance, the Woodrow Wilson Center, if anybody has connections there, the Emerson Hunger Fellows that I've done actually talks for them, and I think they would be really interested in it. And then, of course, the traditional places, maybe the LBJ Library, AHA, OAH, SHA. So I was in the sense of trying to figure out how all of these different kinds of messages, I wasn't thinking about how they cohere in the volume as much as how all these different kinds of messages could get to all these different places once the volume actually comes out, even as we continue to problematize and expand upon what, you know, we're doing in our future work, so.
OBJ Library is definitely a possibility, and I think Wilson Center.
And I know folks at the Hunger Center, so.
Yeah.
I think the readers, scholars, teachers of the freedom movement are going to pick up this avidly, because it really does add a dimension, brings the state back in. But it shows how crucial the state is, was in structuring the problems and as an ingredient of contestation. I'm not as sure that the policymakers, that it's really going to impact them and make a dent. I think there's a lot of material here to show, you know, either a structuralist or just someone who's concerned with the history of the war on poverty as not entirely a failure. I mean, a lot of liberals around too who want to look to the war on poverty for models. Much of this writing is not couched in policy terms or in terms of policy debates. But if there was to be a way, and I, you know, Rhonda and Guillen, I think it's really a stroke of genius to hold it in a policy venue, right? Perhaps to say, you know, people matter, you know. You're not looking at implementation enough,
and
politics of policy. Yeah.
I mean, the Woodrow Wilson Center is interesting in that sense. The Emerson Hunger Fellows, though, what actually happens there, if we could actually get a forum with them, is they actually have folks they are training. It's almost like a new kind of vista, you know? There are folks that they're training around the issues of hunger and around the issues of poverty and around all the related issues of health and housing. And then they actually do placements. But they have this intense session, or it's, you know, this time period where they do intense sessions where they bring scholars in and activists in to actually do training sessions with them to get them to think about specific issues. And in that sense, you know, it's not policy in the sense of passing bills and legislation, but it's policy in the sense of folks who are going out and who eventually will find themselves placed. The hope is to get placed in policy apparatuses. So, I mean, that, you know, if we could get access to those kinds of things. I think that also, even if the specific essays don't, quote unquote, lend themselves to the policy arena as is with the deep historical meats and complicated, you know, complications and nuances that we bring up, that doesn't mean that when the volume actually comes out that we can't extend that conversation in terms of talking about why it's so necessary to have these kinds of deep conversations and actual literature to then talk about what it means for you. How could you potentially use something that you think is disconnected from what you're doing?
So maybe what we're doing is offering suggestions to the folks that will write the intros and conclusions, right?
Yeah.
Because if policymakers are going to read anything, they're going to read that.
Yeah.
Well, I think in terms, too, of what you kind of try to highlight and bring out in your essays.
Yes.
Just to keep that dimension in mind.
Things that will actually get read by possible. We could think about a format, you know, publication of the American Prospect or something, where they do relatively extended kind of special inserts on a particular topic within a couple times a year within the magazine. And if we could all synthesize, you know, the challenge of summarizing these papers in whatever short form it would be, that would just get the ideas out and in circulation. And I think you know, one day events would be great as well, but this would get it in print format in a way that's going to promote circulation of the book, but literally get these ideas, these stories into play in the framework of challenging the consensus on the war on poverty. And quasi-policy, quasi, well, it's a long word, but many like the American Prospect, where it's a connection between academic work, policy people.
I think it's important to be very upfront about what the book isn't about and what it is about. And one of the themes that we've talked about a lot is the fact that this is not a return to the question of did it fail or did it succeed. It's about what is the war on poverty actually about, and adopting perspectives that are very different from grassroots, and defining the war on poverty via the people that are actually involved, for the most part, you know, within the programs, changes the way you actually conceptualize the war on poverty and its meaning, the meaning that it holds. So, I mean, I think coming really out front and saying you're going to transcend this entire debate because it's misframed, you know, something very bold I think would be worth saying, and moving the discussion into a whole nother arena from a very different set of points of view.
I agree substantively, but if we're talking about reaching people, we've got to have a hook, and you've got to hook them where they are, and that's where a lot of policy people still are.
Well, maybe we need to reach out to history then, reach like in the public administration schools or stuff, going to the LBJ library, who's going to show up there, other historians.
No, well, I mean,
but it, ironically, it's a policy moment where words like empowerment and voluntarism, you know, play into a certain agenda, and they don't have to play into that agenda, because we've got examples of voluntarism and self-help here that are very policy relevant and involve, you know, embracing as part of the democratic process some conflict. Or we've got instances of empowerment where it's not just, as important as that is, self-esteem and self-perception, but historically oppressed communities' ability to wield power vis-a-vis the institutions and, you know, maybe the electoral process.
This is just a small suggestion, but some of you may come across this LISTSERV community organizing run by Randy Stoker at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it's, it'd be a good place to kind of advertise this volume and maybe even do some sort of discussion, because it's geared towards academics and sort of practitioners in the field. And it runs job ads too, so a lot of people read it, and also sort of foundation funders. They were in a big debate recently about Obama versus Edwards on this grassroots community organizing issue. But yeah, people are always posting for interesting books that they can use in training community organizers, and this seemed like, and they get into very substantive discussions and debates over it. So,
how do you find it?
I could email it to you. I think that if you just like Google Randy Stoker and community organizing in University of Wisconsin-Madison, you would probably come up with, there's a whole site with all these different kind of white papers on different community organizing. Much of it isn't really historical, but for the purposes you're talking about, it would be useful. But I'll get it. It's a long, complicated email address, and I can send it to you.
Thank you.
Building on the Southern focus, too, I would suggest the Terry Sanford Institute. Same time, you know, yeah. North Carolina Fine. Of course, that piggyback on that, they are loaded. And you can have food just as good down there.
Well, Katie.
But yeah, we just came back from the Logic Park conference. But,
yeah. Well, and I was going to make a grand gesture for somebody in Duke Roots, and I'm suggesting that the Poverty Center at UNC would be an equally stable venue.
Good.
I don't know if that gets to Lori's question. I mean, the conversation we had, I mean, I'm wondering what you're thinking now in terms of the question you raised about things fitting together. That doesn't mean I'm not putting you in your spot. You can just say I'm still thinking.
Well, let's take the governor's suggestion. Everybody write a press release for the volume. Let's see what you come up with. Or an op-ed coming out of it.
Well,
I think that's important.
I know that I was thinking a lot this morning about, you know, besides the book, what do we want to say? It's really feeling that I want to write something beyond the book. That, you know, for I was thinking about I think the American Prospect is a stroke of genius, though I was thinking more about the Atlantic as a venue for, you know, for sort of entering into public discourse on these issues. And, you know, I guess what I would say is that I'm delighted to hear other people being very concerned about this issue. And I think that we're all capable spokespeople. And one of the great things about having volume like this is that, you know, if all of us do a little, that becomes a lot. and there's certainly time for us to think about ways in which each one of us can be part of bringing these ideas and, you know, bringing these new ways of structuring the issues into the current political dialogue. It's not something that we need to or even can resolve right now, but I just encourage continuing to brainstorm on these things. And I would also say, because Mark said it, and you're exactly right, Annalise and I are both open to thoughts about what needs to go in the introduction and the conclusion, because that's where people will make their decision about whether or not they dive in and read your essays. And we want them read. One could write an entire book based on, you know, a synthetic monograph based on everything that's here, and to limit that to an introduction and a conclusion, you know, in ways is daunting. So please, feel free to share your thoughts, not just now, as I see us going past our pickup time, but, you know, by email, by phone, whatever.
We need a new synthesis of the war on poverty, too.
Excuse me?
We need a new synthesis of the war on poverty that Norton's going to pick up and we can assign to our students.
But maybe not
Ian's
yet.
Ian's going to do that.
Maybe not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
There's a lot of books in the pipeline here.
One of us.
And they will come out and flower, and then a few years.
2020 or something.
We can start
like
thinking
that.
About it.
We do need it. I know, Mark, you got it.
What about for you?
Yeah.
I didn't mean for this to be quite as loosely ended the session as it is, but at the same time, I do feel okay about the fact that things are left not at all tied up, because the idea is simply just to keep the conversation going. And, you know, Ian and I might think a little bit about sort of instrumental ways of doing that, if I can enlist you in that. But thank you all, because, you know, people have been thanking us. Which I really appreciate, I'm sure Ian does as well, but, you know, it's all about you guys. This conference group exists without you, so thank you.